The Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, was previously known as Zaire, a name derived from a Portuguese mistranscription of the regional word for river. It wore that moniker from 1971 until 1997, and this region had a rich history of redesignations before that, having been owned by various local kingdoms, then having been colonized by Europeans, sold to the King of Belgium in 1885, who owned it personally, not as a part of Belgium, which was unusual until 1908, renaming it for that period the Congo Free State, which was kind of a branding exercise to convince all the Europeans who held territory thereabouts that he was doing philanthropic work, though while he did go to war with local and Arab slavers in the region, he also caused an estimated millions of deaths due to all that conflict, due to starvation and disease, and due to punishments he levied against people who failed to produce sufficient volumes of rubber from plantations that he built in the region. So all that effort and rebranding also almost bankrupted him, the King of Belgium, because of the difficulties operating in this area. Even when you step into it with vast wealth, overwhelming technological and military advantages, and the full backing of a powerful, if distant, nation. After the king's deadly little adventure, the region he held was ceded to the nation of Belgium as a colony, which renamed it the Belgium Congo, and it eventually gained independence from Belgium alongside many other European colonies around the world post-World War II in mid-1960. Almost immediately, there was conflict, a bunch of secessionist movements turning into civil wars, and those civil wars were amplified by the meddling of the United States and Soviet Union, which supported different sides, funding and arming them as they tended to do in proxy conflicts around the world during this portion of the Cold War. This period, which lasted for about 5 years after independence, became known as the Congo Crisis, because government leaders kept being assassinated, different groups kept rising up, being armed, killing off other groups, and then settling in to keep the government from unifying or operating with any sense of security or normalcy. Eventually, a man named Mobutu Sese Seko, usually just called Mobutu, launched a real-deal coup that succeeded, and he imposed a hardcore military dictatorship on the country. This was his second coup, actually, but the previous one did not result in gaining him any power, so he tried again a few years later, in 1965, and that is the one that worked. And though he claimed, as many coup-launching military dictators do, that he would stabilize things over the next 5 years, restoring democracy to the country in the process, that never happened. Though claiming that he would do all that did earn him the support of the United States and other Western governments for the duration, even as he wiped out any government structure that could oppose him, including the position of the Prime Minister in 1966 and the institution of Parliament in 1967. In 1971, as I mentioned, he renamed the country Zaire, nationalized all remaining foreign-owned assets in the country, and it took another war, which is now called the First Congo War, to finally unseat him. And this conflict, which began in late 1996, spilled over into neighboring countries, including Sudan and Uganda, and a slew of other nations became involved as well, including, but not limited to, Chad, the Central African Republic, Rwanda, Burundi, Angola, Eritrea, South Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, and Tanzania, alongside foreign assistance granted to various sides by France, China, Israel, and covertly, the United States. The conflict kicked off when Rwanda invaded Zaire. More neighboring states joined in, all of them intending to take out a bunch of rebel groups that the Mobutu government was no longer keeping in line, Mobutu himself having long since fallen ill and thus lacking the control he once had. But he was still profiting mightily from outside influences that kept funding him as a friendly toehold in the region. So these other nations sent military forces into Zaire to handle these groups, which were causing untold troubles throughout the region. And the long and the short of this conflict is that it only lasted a few months, from October 1996 until May 1997. But the destruction and carnage caused during that short period was vast. Everyone on both sides partnering up to take out rebels, or in the case of those rebels, joining up against these government militaries that were attacking them, and all of them using the opportunity to also engage in violence against ethnic enemies with whom they had long simmering beefs. This led to the collapse of Mobutu's government. The country was renamed the Democratic Republic of the Congo when a new government was installed, but very little changed in terms of the reality of how that government functioned. So all of the same variables were still in place a year later, in 1998, when what is now called the Second Congo War kicked off, informed by basically the same problems, but bringing even more African governments into the fighting, many of them pulled in by alliances that they had with their involved neighbors. And just as before, a variety of groups who felt aggrieved by other groups throughout the region used this conflict as an excuse to slaughter and destroy people and towns they didn't like, including what's been called a genocide of a group of pygmy people who lived in the area, around 70,000 of them killed in the waning days of the war. In mid-2003, a peace agreement was finally signed. Most of the warring factions that had fought in Congolese territory were convinced to leave, and it was estimated at that point that up to 5.4 million people had died during the conflict. What I'd like to talk about today is what's happening in the DRC now, at a moment of heightening tensions throughout the region, and in the DRC in particular, amidst warnings from experts that another regional conflict could be brewing. You're listening to Let's Know Things. I'm Colin Wright. Learn more about Let's Know Things, subscribe to receive free email updates, and or become a supporter to receive monthly bonus episodes at letsknowthings.com. A transition government was set up in the DRC in 2003, following the official end of that Second Congo War. And this government, though somewhat weak and absolutely imperfect in many ways, did manage to get the country to the point 3 years later, in 2006, that it could hold an actual multi-party election, the country's first ever, which is no small thing. Unfortunately, a dispute related to the election results led to violence between supporters of the two primary candidates, so a second election was held, and that one ended relatively peacefully, and a new president, Joseph Kabila, was sworn in. Kabila was re-elected in 2011, and then in 2018 he said he would not be running again, which helped bring about the country's first peaceful transition of power, when the next president, from the opposing party, stepped into office. During his tenure in office, though, Kabila's DRC was at near-constant war with rebel groups that semi-regularly managed to capture territory, and which were often supported by neighboring countries, alongside conflicts with smaller groups, so-called Maimai militias, that were established in mostly rural areas to protect residents from roaming gangs and other militias, and which sometimes decided to go take other people's stuff or territory, even facing off with government forces from time to time. Violence between ethnic groups has also continued to be a problem, including the use of sexual violence and wholesale attempted genocide, which has been difficult to stop because of the depth of some of the issues these groups have with each other, and in some cases the difficulty the government has had just getting to the places where these conflicts are occurring, infrastructure in some parts of the country being not great where it exists at all. That 2018 election, where power was given away by one president to another peacefully for the first time, was notable in that regard, but it was also a milestone in that it marked the beginning of widespread anti-election conspiracy theories, in that case the Catholic Church saying that the official results were bunk, and other irregularities like a delay of the vote in areas experiencing Ebola outbreaks, those areas in many cases filled with opposition voters, all of that added to suspicions. The most recent election, at the tail end of 2023, was even more awash with such concerns. The 2018 winner, President Tshisekedi, winning re-election with 73% of the vote, and a cadre of 9 opposition candidates, signed a declaration saying that the election was rigged and that they wanted another vote to be held. All of which establishes the context for what's happening in the DRC today, which is in some ways a continuation of what has been happening in the country pretty much since it became a country, but in other ways is an escalation and evolution of the same. One of the big focal points here, though, one of the red threads running through this country, is the role that neighboring Rwanda has played in a lot of what has gone down in the DRC, including the new issues that we are seeing in 2024. Back in 1994, during what became known as the Rwandan genocide, militias from the ruling majority Hutu ethnic group decided to basically wipe out anyone from the minority Tutsi ethnic group. Somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people are estimated to have been killed between April and July of that year alone, and that conflict pushed a lot of Hutu refugees across the border into the eastern DRC, which at the time was still Zaire. About 2 million of these refugees settled in camps in the north and south Kivu provinces of the DRC, and some of them were the same extremists who committed that genocide in Rwanda in 1994. And they started doing what they do in the DRC as well, setting up militias, in this case, mostly in order to defend themselves against the new Tutsi-run government that had taken over in Rwanda following the genocide. This is what sparked the First Congo War, as the Tutsi-run Rwandan government, seeking justice and revenge against those who committed all those atrocities, went on the hunt for any Hutu extremists they could find, and that meant invading a neighboring country in order to hit those refugee groups and the militias living within them that had set up shop there. The Second Congo War was sparked when relations between the Congolese and Rwandan governments deteriorated, the DRC government pushing Rwandan troops out of the eastern part of their country, and Kabila, the leader of the DRC at the time, also asking everyone else to leave, all foreign troops that were helping with those Hutu militias needed to leave their borders. Kabila then allowed the Hutus to reinforce their positions on the border with Rwanda, seemingly as a consequence of a burgeoning international consensus that the Rwandan government's actions following the genocide against the Tutsis had resulted in an overcompensatory countermove by the now Tutsi-led government against the Hutus, many of whom were not involved in that genocide, but the international community was feeling increasingly confident that the Tutsis' actions after the genocide in this regard amounted to war crimes. One of the outcomes of this conflict, that second war, was the emergence of a mostly Tutsi rebel group called the March 24 Movement, or M23, which eventually became a huge force in the region in the early 20-teens, amidst accusations that the Congolese government was backing them. M23 became such an issue for the region that the UN Security Council actually sent troops into the area to work with the Congolese army to fend them off after they made moves to start taking over chunks of the country, and evidence subsequently emerged that Rwanda was supporting the group and their effort in order to screw over the Congolese government, which certainly did not help the two countries' relationship. Alongside M23, ADF, and CODECO, a slew of more than 100 other armed rebel groups still plague portions of the DRC, and part of the issue here is that Rwanda and other neighboring countries that don't like the DRC want to hurt them to whatever degree they're able, so they help fund and support these groups. But another aspect of this seemingly perpetual tumult is the DRC's staggering natural resource wealth. Based on some estimates, the DRC has something like $24 trillion worth of natural resource deposits, including the world's largest cobalt and coltan reserves, two metals that are fundamental to the creation of things like batteries and other aspects of the modern economy, and perhaps especially the modern electrified economy. So in some ways, this is similar to having the world's largest oil deposits back in the early 20th century. It's great in a way, but it's also a resource curse in the sense that everyone wants to steal your stuff, and in the sense that setting up a functioning government that is not a total kleptocracy, corrupt from top to bottom, is difficult because there's just so much wealth just sitting there, and there's no real need to invest in a fully fleshed out functioning economy because you can just take the money other countries offer you in exchange for allowing them to exploit your people and resources, and you can just pocket a significant chunk of that. So while that is not 100% what happened to the DRC, it's not far off. During the early 2000s and into the 20-teens, the DRC government sold essentially all of its mining rights to China, which has put China in control of the lion's share of some of the world's most vital elements for modern technology. The scramble to strike these deals and subsequent efforts to defend and stabilize on one hand, or to attack and destabilize these mining operations on the other, have also contributed to instability in the region because local groups have been paid and armed to either defend or attack. Soldiers and mercenaries from all over the world have been moved to the area to do the same, and the logic of Cold War era proxy conflicts has enveloped this part of Africa to such a degree that rival nations like Uganda are buying drones and artillery from China to strike targets within the DRC, even as China arms DRC-based rebel groups to back up official military forces that are protecting their mining interests. It's a mess, and it is a mess because of all those historical conditions and beefs, because of conflicts in other nearby countries and the machinations of internal and external leaders, and because of the amplification of all of these things, resulting from international players with interests in the DRC, including China, but also China's rivals, all of whom want what they have, and in some cases just don't want China to have what they currently have. In 2022, M23 resurfaced after laying low for years, and they took a huge chunk of North Kivu in 2023. For a moment that same year, it looked like Rwanda and the DRC might go to war with each other over mining interests that Rwanda controls in the DRC, but a pact negotiated by the US led to a reduction in the military buildup in the area, and a reduction in their messing with each other's political systems. In December of 2023, though, the president of the DRC compared the president of Rwanda to Hitler, and threatened to declare war against him, and UN troops, who have become incredibly unpopular in the region, in part because of various scandals and corruption within their ranks, began to withdraw, something that the US and UN have said could lead to a power vacuum in the area, sparking new conflicts in an already conflict-prone part of the country. As of March 2024, soldiers from South Africa, Burundi, and Tanzania are fighting soldiers from Rwanda who are supporting M23 militants in the eastern portion of the DRC, these militants already having taken several towns. 7 million Congolese citizens are internally displaced as a result of these conflicts, having had to flee their homes due to all the violence, most of them now living in camps or wandering from place to place, unable to settle down anywhere due to other violence and a lack of sufficient resources to support them. Rwanda, for its part, denies supporting M23, and it says the Congolese government is trying to expel Tutsis who live in the DRC. Burundi, located just south of Rwanda, has closed its border with Rwanda, and has also accused Rwanda of supporting rebels within their borders with the intent of overthrowing the Burundian government. Most Western governments have voiced criticisms of Rwanda for deploying troops within its neighbors' borders, and for reportedly supporting these militant groups, but they continue to send the Rwandan government money. Rwanda gets about a third of its total budget from other governments, and the US is at the top of that list of donors, but the EU also sends millions to Rwanda each year, mostly to fund military actions aimed at taking out militant extremist groups that make it hard to do business in the region. So changes in political stances are contributing to this cycle of violence and instability, as are regular injections of outside resources like money and weapons and soldiers. And as this swirl of forces continues to make the DRC borderline ungovernable, raising the potential for a new multi-nation conflict in the region, everyday people continue to be butchered and displaced, experiencing all sorts of violence and food shortages and a lack of basic necessities like water. And this ongoing and burgeoning humanitarian nightmare could go on to inform and spark future conflicts in the region as well. The book I'd like to recommend today is called Everyday Utopia: What 2,000 Years of Wild Experiments Can Teach Us About the Good Life, by Kristen R. Gottsie. This book is full of interesting explorations of mostly communes and other sorts of alternative living situations that have occurred in different countries over the course of history. And each of these stories are interesting unto themselves, but it's also compelling to look at the different ingredients that these different groups of people have used, the different things that they've considered to be important, and the ways they've tried to amplify the good stuff and get rid of other ills that they've considered to be bad aspects, negative aspects of the societies they were stepping away from, and how they've woven those things into new societal arrangements, with sometimes not so great, sometimes pretty incredible, and sometimes fairly neutral, but different consequences. Now, if any of that sounds interesting to you, consider picking up a copy of Everyday Utopia by Kristen R. Gottsie. You can subscribe to receive email updates, find show notes, and other such content, and support this show financially, receiving additional bonus episodes as a thank you at letsknowthings.com. Learn more about me and my work at colin.io. Subscribe to my other news-focused podcast, One Sentence News, wherever you get your pods, or at onesentencenews.com. And say howdy on social media. I'm at Colin is my name on Instagram and Twitter, and Colin Wright on Facebook and YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Colin Wright, and I'll talk to you again next week.